accession number 17596, reel 2.
Wicksnead, reel 2.
Yes, I think I was saying that I said to Prince Andrew, of course it was, that things got exciting. There's always a way, no doubt, that we could get him out if that was the thing that needed to be done. I'm not too sure I necessarily believed it myself, but nevertheless, it was always there. But as time went by, and he was as committed as anybody else, his role actually became no more important than any being any sub-lieutenant pilot, but there was a slight difference, and we could develop that if you wish. But by and large, I mean, he did what any junior pilot did, and he was not given any particularly difficult missions above the norm, because those missions were given to people who I might describe as my first 11. So he did his bit in the way that I would expect an officer of his seniority and experience to do. But he certainly, his presence gave one a little bit more to think about.
So, you're going into the exclusion zone. Can you take me forward now, please?
Yes. I mean, the first day was obviously a day of immense activity. I was airborne, and I remember very vividly watching the Harriers leave Hermes on their attack run into Fort Stanley Airfield. I think at the time we all had sort of ideas about what might happen and the type of engagements we were going to get caught up in. And it's very easy now to look back and overlook those in the light of what subsequently happened. And I think we perhaps felt the threat from the aircraft carrier the 25th of May very strongly. We thought, some of us thought, we could be in a carrier-type battle. The Belgrano, of course, was a large ship with, though not highly sophisticated, nevertheless very heavy armament. And of course they had a lot of aircraft. And on that particular day, I can remember flying in and out of the clouds, trying to orientate myself as to where the likely threat was going to be, and how, from the air, that is, and how I was going to respond if I should meet it, because I think there were raids going on. And though as a helicopter one was unlikely to be targeted by any raid on the way in, for obvious reasons you weren't much of a prize, but certainly a raid on the way out might find you a nice opportunity to target if you hadn't got anything else to expend his weapons on. So that day was actually a very exciting and intense day, and of course it was a day for us to start trying to settle into what was obviously going to be a fairly prolonged period.
How did you find the weather conditions in the area?
The weather changed very rapidly, and it could be absolutely glorious. It was winter, of course, and it was cold, but it could be very, very clear, very bright, sunny days, to absolutely foul gales, a lot of fog, a tremendous amount of fog. And fog, funny enough, that travelled at up to 13.5 knots, which I remember on occasions. So flying conditions down there were pretty foul, but more so, they were foul for the people who had to operate the flight decks, the maintainers and the aircraft handlers. So I think what happened, firstly, that The Argentinians shut down all their weather broadcasts to the world, and the weather came from their direction. So our information wasn't as good as we'd normally expect it to be down there. And then I think that the sort of local, well, I say it's local, the weather effects in that area mean that weather tends to sort of bottle up on the western side of South America and then suddenly rush through. And that, I think that may be the reason why you get this tremendously quick change. So, I mean, some very, very heavy seas at times and very nasty gales and very unpleasant conditions. But conversely, some days it would be flat, calm, long swell and looking really rather nice. But we didn't bank on it staying that way for very long. And, of course, we were operating in, at times, a heavy snow as well, particularly in June. So it was a variation.
Anything else that you recollect from that first day in the exclusion zone?
I can't remember when exactly all the incidents happened, but it wasn't long after the first day that Sheffield was hit. And that was a moment of significance. I think, it was a very sobering effect. Here was a modern destroyer taken out initially by something we didn't actually know what it was. The initial reaction was it was a torpedo. It wasn't sometime after she hit that it was realised in the fleet, certainly, that it was an Exocet that had got her. And I think also it was a sort of salutary lesson, the way, to remind us of just how sharp we've got to be, and that really this world's desperately for real. And I think in some ways it was a bit of a price to pay to get the fleet really everybody into really top gear to be really alert, because I think maybe those at that time were still having difficulties of really coming to terms, really believing this is 100% real and it really does affect them. And I think that was an important occasion for that aspect. It also, I think, began to focus people's attentions as to who were the pawns and who were the kings and queens of the chessboard, as it were. And undoubtedly, we found that the thought and the expectation was that we were going to be a lot more pawns going down before the end of this game. And the king and the queen, perhaps, if I use that rather poor analogy, being the two aircraft carriers, were absolutely vital, because without them, any thought of being able to retake those islands vanished. So I think that initial period of suddenly finding oneself quite a long way from the islands, conducting your business, was in some ways quite surprising, because I suppose a great deal of thought one would be really in the thick of it. But of course I suppose the philosophy was that we were wearing away at the problem with the tips of our knuckles, but making sure we actually didn't expose ourselves to more risk than we really needed to, because as I say, loss of one carrier maybe, but certainly loss of both carriers, we'd been in tremendous trouble. And certainly I think my personal view is that one would not have been able to land on the islands without that essential air cover. But I think that was also another feature of the Falklands I found, which was an interesting exercise in being in command, that when you actually faced missions that were slightly more demanding and contained more risks, you looked at it in a rather different way to perhaps one thought in the past you might have looked at it. In other words, you knew jolly well that if you lost an aircraft, you were not going to get another one for another 8 weeks or more. And therefore, and if you lost a crew with your aircraft, which is even more expensive, but not just from the point of view of that, it was actually, as I remarked earlier, it wasn't a game where you were back to the shores of Dover defending your country. You were actually out doing a job which is a sort of precision job. And so to my mind, the whole idea was to actually get the mission done, but minimise the risks in doing so, because you didn't want to waste your assets, and you certainly didn't want to waste your people unnecessarily. So one's philosophy, as it were, was ready to use all the sort of guidance you had to achieve that aim. And to that, and in that way, one of the things we did do in my squadron, we stayed very much using peacetime rules of aviation in the way we flew our aircraft, in terms of the limits to which we flew, where we could do so and still complete the mission. Because I took the view that all these rules for aircraft clearances and the deck limits and all the rest of it have been tried and tested over many years, and if you could happily operate within them and achieve the mission, that's fine. If, on the other hand, to achieve a mission you had to go outside these limits because you needed to carry more than your aircraft was actually meant to fly with, etc., 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 that sort of thing, then you consciously knew that you were going outside these tried and tested limits. And it became a process of thought of, well, okay, we're going to do this, how do we best do it? And there were ways in which you went about this, which ensured that you were more likely to be successful than just sort of leaping into the aeroplane and pulling out the collective and shooting over the side of the ship without giving it a thought. So I found that in itself was interesting in terms of the way in which you approached these operational missions. And it wasn't quite as I had I suspect grown up with a sort of idea, perhaps it was thrown around the crew room, so come the war, we throw out the rule book. No, the rule book was jolly helpful, because when you went outside it, you knew you were, and you thought how you were best going to do your job and bring your aircraft and crew back, but importantly, get the mission done successfully.
What about the Argentinians' loss of the submarine at South Georgia?
Well, that... I mean, interestingly enough, it was an extraordinary occasion, because I went down to the operations room, I think, at one stage, and they were actually listening to it on a radio frequency, and it was miles away. And it was one of those freak conditions where radio waves sort of bent round, and we just happened to be able to listen to this engagement. One heard this very spirited action going on, a helicopter pilot telling us how he was engaging the submarine, which was on surface. She was a rather ancient submarine. I don't think she was an enormous threat in terms of sophistication as the other two were. But I think that gave us a sort of flavour of what might be coming. And of course, this we're coming along, because this, I think, happened before we actually really got into anything serious ourselves, if I remember rightly. And that was one feature of it. I think the other thing was extremely unpleasant weather conditions down there. And I think the Marines felt that, and I know certainly a colleague of mine who was flight commander of Antrim, who went ashore in the most appalling conditions and managed to retrieve a number of people, including our crew, who actually crashed ashore. But it did give us the impression, a very clear impression of exactly, that we were up against not only an enemy, but also some pretty unpleasant elements.
What happened to you next?
Well, I mean, throughout May and the entire conflict, I mean, I was always on board Invincible. We did, towards the end of our time, send some of the squadron ashore. What I think the Admiral tried to do was to maintain my squadron as the squadron that was basically looking after the carriers. For the point of view of the anti-submarine side and the surface surveillance, and we were the last people to be tasked to do other operations in general, although I think looking back now, funnily enough, 25% of my flying hours was done in what we call helicopter delivery service, and vertical replenishment was a tremendous high proportion, and we were the last people to be tasked to do it. So we kept up this consistent anti-submarine sort of screen and surface surveillance screen around the task force, day and night, throughout the period. We did do one or two other operations, particularly into the Falklands and San Carlos, trying to provide surveillance during the night on the western side of the islands. This was obviously after the landings, and doing some military support during the day there. We got involved in operations such as taking the Narwhal, which was a trawler that had been commandeered, I think, by some lieutenant commander of the Argentinian Navy, and used as a spy ship, crewed by a whole lot of rather luckless fishermen. We managed to capture her with the help of a Harrier and a lot of Marines. I think we were in the end using a sledgehammer to crack a fairly ordinary nut, but we didn't know that it was going to be a fairly ordinary nut at the time. What else?
Were you in that yourself?
Yes, I was flying in that operation, but we were just providing the command and control in the gunship, whilst some Seeking Mark IVs, the commandos, Seekings, brought the Marines down, and I think a Harrier flew around on top doing his best to terrorise them into submission. Other than that, we did a certain amount of search and rescue. We got involved in trying to protect Sheffield after she'd been sunk, to assist in her retrieval, being towed out, which was a rather sad occasion in a way, because it led to, well, it didn't lead, but it was actually the time of a loss of two of our fixed wing aircraft who were in the combat air patrol position above where Sheffield was sitting. And it was an interesting incident, because one of the features of the air group in Invincible was that both squadrons got on extremely well. Carriers of the past, and the old type of carriers, the squadrons normally used to, as they would say, fight mainly through competition, whatever. But there was, I don't think, by and large, much closeness between the squadrons. But certainly in Invincible, we were the first, of course, of that class, and the first air group to be operational. My opposite number and I decided that our squadrons would do better to get on than actually be in direct competition to one another. I'd introduced this subject a year or so before, but on the basis that I had 50 officers in the wardroom and my opposite number only had 10, and they were, mine were rather bigger anyway, so wouldn't it be a good idea if we got on? And we did. And I go back to this incident, actually wasn't this incident, another incident came along, but this incident. I had two aircraft deployed forward around Sheffield as she lay dead in the water, having put out the fire. And whilst deliberations were going on as to whether we should tow her out, a matter which I actually felt some enthusiasm for, at the same time we knew that one of the Argentinian small 109 submarines was, well, we thought we knew, was under instructions to engage any ship coming down to try and tow out the Sheffield. And so that's why I had two aircraft up there, either side, northwest and southwest of Sheffield. And Sheffield was essentially due east of Falkland. And these two Harrier aircraft were above in what we call cap stations, combat air patrol stations, above this sea. My helicopter to the northwest of Sheffield detected on its radar, which wasn't optimized for detecting air contacts, to the northwest of him, a fleeting contact which the observer deemed was wholly consistent with a sort of maritime patrol aircraft, and called back to Invincible that he'd got this contact. The Harrier above him was then towed, or in his region, was towed to get over and find out what was going on. And the other Harrier came across, and I think I went out subsequently to try and find the bits. They and me there collided, and we didn't find anything. The point of my story is that what happened as a result of that, we lost two valuable aircraft, and of course a sizable proportion of our defence assets. That later that evening, after I recovered from trying to find these two pilots, my duty officer brought me a signal which had come from the flagship, which I read with some horror, and the signal went down the line that the misreporting of one helicopter by another has led to the loss of two valuable air assets. And I looked at this and went round to the briefing room of my opposite number squadron, the Harrier squadron, and said to my opposite number, "Have you seen this?" Fearing that if it was believed, then of course there would be a very difficult situation to contend with between our two squadrons. Immediately my opposite number said, "We know that's a load of rubbish." And I subsequently went down to my captain to discuss the matter with him. And there was no way that that could have been the case. But the implications for morale would have been horrendous had not the two squadrons got on extremely well and actually known a lot about what we were doing, which wouldn't always have been the case in the past at all. So that, and on other occasions, the benefits of the close way that we as two squadrons operated together became apparent to us at that time. As we sit here in this house in Dorset, I've just returned from a period abroad, and the person who rented this house in my absence, quite fortuitously, was a man who we spent all night looking for, another Harrier pilot who got shot down. And I think he would admit, and I certainly believe, that he wouldn't have been here to rent my house if we hadn't had the closeness between our two squadrons, because it was actually a very interesting rescue by my senior pilot in the end.
What other operations stick in your mind that you or your unit were concerned with then?
Well, we just mentioned, I just alluded to one particular incident, which was to do with search and rescue. And I think search and rescue is a very important feature in any campaign. During the Second World War, of course, RAF had their launches in the Channel trying to fish back their pilots from the Battle of Britain. Indeed, when you look at the history of naval warfare and aviation war operations at sea, I don't know my statistics, but I have a strong sense that we've lost more people to the elements, to accidents, to tiredness, than we ever have done to enemy action. And our ability to actually get people or rescue people and return them to be useful and effective members of your fighting forces, actually extremely important. So quite a lot of our time was devoted to being able to maintain search and rescue capability. And I one day was flying during daylight hours above the crest of the waves rather quickly, about a few miles off Stanley Airfield. Had a young second pilot who was actually flying the aircraft at the time, and as we came level with Stanley, and I was trying to get a look at what was going on in there, but conscious that once we were spotted there would be some rather unpleasant aircraft coming out towards us to make sure that we didn't return, suddenly an autotone signal went off on the radio frequency. Now, in the aircraft, we would listen to the tactical frequency, and we could listen to other frequencies as well, because you had a central communications box, And one of the things you automatically always listened into was the distress frequency. And when an ejection seat leaves a fighter, there's a piece of equipment which is called autotone, which transmits a beeping noise on the distress frequency. It's quite striking noise for obvious reasons. It's trying to alert people, and that's done automatically. Well, as we were flying along, and the crest of the waves going absolutely flat out, in a high state of tension, obviously, suddenly this autotone came off the frequency, and my second pilot, who was flying, thought, having never heard it before, the world was about to end and the Argies were on us. Started to throw the aircraft around. Of course, by the time I got my hand down to try and get a bearing of this, the actual transmission had ceased. And I didn't know where this incident was, and I assumed it was probably out over San Carlos, which was some way 40, 50 miles, I can't remember exactly, to the west of us. Anyway, I was short of fuel, didn't have time to hang around. The carriers were off to the east 100 miles, and it was time to go. When I got back on board, I discovered that this was one of our aircraft that had been shot down to the south. I can't remember the name of the place, but it was a missile site east of Goose Green on the coastline. But anyway, well to the south where I was. So we set up a search and rescue operation to try and find this man. And I knew that from the intelligence I had, and putting together the picture when I got back, he must have been to the south of where I had been when I'd heard this autotone. So we looked and looked and looked, and at about 2 o'clock in the morning, my captain said to me that he was quite keen that we stopped this rescue operation during the night, because by then it was, and continue again the first light. And I said that I'd rather go on at night, because I knew that come first light, the Argentinian aircraft would be out waiting for us. And as luck would have it, my senior pilot played a hunch and actually started to look in the area which I'd actually been in when this incident had happened. And the pilot, who was a flight lieutenant on exchange with 801 Squadron, Harris Squadron, had actually been looked at during the daylight hours as he sat in his dinghy and sort of covered himself up as best as he could to make sure that he was less visible to the Argentinian aircraft, and actually stopped transmitting on his distress beacon, sort of thing we call SABI, and had laid very quiet as night fell. And as a piece of extraordinary luck, he managed to hear my senior pilot's aircraft in the distance and switched on a very small strobe light and was subsequently seen. So I thought, quite remarkably, sometime later appeared on board a rather wet, bedraggled RAF officer, quite glad to be alive.
Any other incidents you can recount?
It's actually difficult to think back now, because everyone's talking many years ago. But specifically, I mean, one remembers, of course, the feelings of being under attack by the Argentinian Naval Air Arm and their Air Force. I think, of course, the prime threat was perceived to be by the man walking around the ship as being the Exocet missile. And I think it was initially, in so much, I think it caught us a bit on the hop,